We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, diving in to local issues, starting with the 520 bridge.
Diving in?
Yes.
It's a good jumping off point.
Yes. Talking about the 520 bridge. Yeah, on Monday, Mike McGinn, our mayor, and a bunch of community groups and a few Seattle politicians got together and proposed a change to the state's plan for the 520 bridge rebuild. Now, the state's plan would change the 520 bridge to a six-lane span with four regular traffic lanes and two carpool lanes. Well, the McGinn plan wants to have six lanes, of course, but with those four traffic lanes, they want two transit-only lanes, and it'd be even better if those two lanes were devoted to light rail. Well, the Governor Greg Warr responded that same day and said, oh, no, it's too late to change now. You'd need to do a whole new environmental impact statement for that, and that would delay the project by a year and a half to 2 years, et cetera, et cetera. Well, a King 5 Survey USA poll of 500 Seattle residents show that 46% of those 500 Seattle residents want those two lanes of traffic for light rail, and that only 33% would like those two lanes for HOV lanes or carpool lanes.
Well, there's several other things going on here as well, of course. One is that the state apparatus, and that includes the governor's office, it includes the state legislature, it includes the Department of Transportation, are all deeply suspicious of McGinn's intent toward the downtown tunnel as well. And, you know, want to make sure that they don't, and they're also deeply suspicious of Seattle's ability to come to any kind of a decision on anything. And, you know, just don't want any of it reopened, regardless of what the public opinion is, regardless of what, you know, makes more or less sense in terms of transportation planning. And the 520 process to this date hasn't just involved Seattle. There's also a lot of stakeholders on the east side, and you know, they just don't want to open that can of worms. Above and beyond that, you also have this bill that's winding its way through the legislature that would take away from Seattle or any municipality, but it's clearly aimed at Seattle, its ability to issue permits or exercise any kind of oversight over state highway transportation projects. And of course, that's aimed squarely at both the 520 bridge project and at the downtown tunnel, which is SR 99. So there's a lot of tension going on here, and it's very interesting to see that one of the things that McGinn campaigned on was repairing the frayed relationship between the Nichols administration and decision makers in Olympia, when it seems like pretty much what he's been doing since he's gone into office has been the exact opposite, and it's not like Greg Warr and the legislature and the transportation folks in the legislature have been holding out any olive branches either. There's a lot of tension and a lot of mistrust between those parties at this point.
Yeah, but I think there's another dynamic there as well, too. It doesn't seem to be strictly McGinn versus the legislature over the 520 bridge, too, because some of the folks who were in the coalition with McGinn who stood up and said, look, we'd like those two lanes to be for transit and not for carpools, included Senator Ed Murray, who represents Seattle in the legislature, and Representative Jamie Peterson from Seattle as well,
yeah,
including a whole bunch of...
And the 43rd includes Motlake, which is the neighborhood that
right,
directly affected.
Right, and it includes a whole bunch of neighborhood groups, too, who would have to see a lot of the construction work going on when the interchange is built on this side of the bridge in Motlake and connecting it to I-5. So there's a whole bunch of other people involved in this, too. And so on Thursday, it was kind of interesting. Oh, and we also saw, too, a couple of city council members stand up with McGinn.
Yeah. What we did not see, though, is the chair of the State Transportation Committee in the legislature, or Frank Chopp, who's also in the 43rd.
Right. But as I was saying, what we saw is a couple of city council members, Nick Licata and Mike O'Brien, the two more environmentally inclined city council members, stand up with McGinn and say, look, there's a principle here, and it has to do with how we deal with enormous amounts of traffic coming in and going out of the city, and problems with overcrowding on the roads, and what we want our future to look like. And then on Thursday, the group that came out, they called themselves East Siders, who came out and said, well, we want the HOV lanes. We want it to be 6 lanes. We don't want 2 dedicated lanes for transit only. We support Governor Gregoire and the state's plan. That group did include some East Side mayors, but it also included City Council President Richard Conlon, and it included the downtown Seattle Chamber of Commerce president, too. So that's kind of interesting. It doesn't strictly break out as Seattle versus the state legislature, Seattle versus the East Side. What it breaks out as, in my view, is neighborhood groups in the city of Seattle and the environmentally minded versus business interests on both sides of
Although Conlon would tell you that he's an environmentalist, too.
Oh, so I know he would.
I don't know how you explain that one.
I don't know how he explains that one, but let's leave it at that.
All right, well, speaking of explanations, that moves on to our next topic, which is temper tantrum down in Olympia.
You said that in the singular, as though there's only one. Yeah.
talking about the latest one.
The latest temper tantrum.
Well, yeah, actually, it isn't so much a temper tantrum as it's a response to a series of temper tantrums over the years, or maybe it's just one 12-year-long temper tantrum. But the Republican State Caucus last week censured State Senator Pam Roach, a wingnut from South County, who has gotten in a lot of hot water over the years for any number of things, including, you know, packing a gun around the state capitol, yelling at interns and staff people. She had a famous eruption a few years ago when somebody supposedly moved a vase of flowers that was on her desk. She got into some ethical troubles a few years ago when her son, who was in jail on drug charges, mysteriously got released early. There's been a lot of issues around Pam Roach, and she's been warned repeatedly about her anger management issues.
I think is the
politically correct way of saying it. In other words, the woman has a temper, and she is notorious for not treating her aides and her staff people well. Well, the Republican State Caucus said basically, you can't caucus with us. You cannot use the caucus room. You cannot have interns from the state caucus. You're paying for those yourselves. And don't shoot any of us. It was a remarkably strongly worded 3-page letter to Roach that basically said, you know, Senator Roach, we've warned you time and time and time again, and we just cannot work with you. You're just too out there, even for us. And as I've been mentioning,
that's her own party saying.
And as I mentioned over the past month, this is the state Republicans who are pretty out there to begin with. So if they're saying that Roach is unworkable even for them, you know, people in her district who certainly know at this point that she's got some anger issues and that she's a little bit of quite a bit of a loose cannon. They need to really look pretty carefully at whether she can be an effective representative for them.
Moving on. Seattle Times last Sunday started a series on adult care homes here in the state.
Yeah, and kind of an expose on the folks who have been a number of cases where folks have been abused or suffered a lot of neglect in adult care homes, and some of the lawsuits that have come out of that. And Governor Gregoire then announced later this week that she was going to have DSHS, the Department of Social and Health Services, do a review of adult care homes and do a little bit deeper investigation into them than they have in the past. Well, what she didn't do is she didn't mention that she was going to start any effort to tighten the licensing of adult care homes. That would certainly help some. And she didn't say anything about minimal staffing requirements. There are no minimal staffing requirements at adult care homes. And she didn't address the worst finding in the Seattle Times articles, which was that the DSHS, the Department of Social and Health Services, the state that is pushing Medicaid patients out of nursing home care where they really belong and into these adult care homes where there's minimal medical care for them. And they're doing that because it saves the state money.
We should define what is an adult care home.
Yeah, and adult care homes were originally set up for folks who are aging and would like a place to live where they have some assistance in their living, but they don't need a lot of medical care. They want to be pretty independent, but they still have some needs. They still need a little bit of help around the house. They might need a little bit of supervision, but they're generally pretty independent. Well, what's going on in this state is that the State Department of Social and Health Services, the supervisors there, and I'm sure it's coming from above them as well, are getting pressure to push Medicaid patients out of nursing home care, where you get a lot more medical attention and you have a lot more supervision, into these minimal supervision situations and minimal care facilities, these adult care centers. And it's because they're cheaper and because it saves the state money. And Gregoire did not make any announcement that she was going to try to change that policy.
Yeah. The other thing that I found fascinating about the Times series, and now mind you, this is the sort of investigative journalism that the Times does anymore, which is that two or three times a year they'll do an investigative series which they really hope will win them a Pulitzer, or at least a mention of a Pulitzer, but other than that they don't really do a whole lot of their own reporting anymore, but this is sort of like the loss leader to get you to think that they actually still have an investigative journalism staff that does more than these, you know, a handful of boutique series. But The Times doesn't particularly have clean hands on this either, because a few years ago there was an actual initiative that would have regulated some of these homes a little bit more safely and increased the standards of them and increased the qualifications needed to work at these homes. And the Times editorial board came out strongly against that initiative. And the reason they did it, of course, was that it was being pushed by SEIU, which was a union which probably would have benefited by the unionization of those workers. And Frank Blethyn, in particular, the publisher of the Times, really still hasn't gotten over the newspaper strike from 10 years ago. And anything that has to do with anything about a union, he is reflexively against. So here you have the Times, which really pulled out all the stops, you know, to oppose a measure that would have addressed some of these issues, and now they're trying to make hay by pointing out that, hey, here are these issues, and hoping that nobody remembers far enough back to when they helped to not create the problem, certainly, but prevent any kind of remediation of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Moving on to this time of year for initiatives to be put out there for ideas and signatures, and one of them is for a higher income tax.
Well, for a handful of people, actually, but and not just a higher income tax, but an income tax period, because, of course, right now we don't have an income tax
in the
state of Washington.
It's an income tax on higher-earning individuals.
Yes, exactly. So we had a group that filed an initiative with the Secretary of State's office a week ago yesterday for a high-earners income tax. That has to be the language has to be approved by the Secretary of State's office, and you know that takes a few weeks, and then they can gather signatures, which would probably take them up until July, and they would have to gather a certain number of signatures in order to get that on the ballot. And probably it's not a real good chance that we get on the ballot, but it's certainly possible. There's been some polling that suggests that folks, especially with the budget crisis that the state is facing right now, that there's been some polling that would suggest that initiative like that would have a chance. And of course, down in the state of Oregon, just last week we saw a special election in which exactly that type of a high earners income tax increase there, because they already have an income tax, was approved. So they went ahead and filed this with the Secretary of State's office, and then the Secretary of State's office turns around immediately and says, well, of course, something like that is completely unconstitutional, and therefore, it'll be a no-go. Well, the problem with that is that's not the Secretary of State's job to pass judgment on whether a proposed initiative is constitutional or not. What they vet is the wording of the petition is clear. They check the signatures to make sure the signatures are valid, and then it would be the Attorney General's office's job to pass a recommendation on whether it thought it was constitutional or not. But ultimately, it's up to the courts to decide. And the courts on an income tax in Washington State are a very interesting question, because the precedent that is used to judge an income tax as being unconstitutional in Washington State goes back to 1933. And at the time that ruling was done, it was based on a whole line of U.S. Supreme Court precedent that has since been overturned. And not only has it been overturned, but that same definition of what constitutes income has been overturned in something like 47 of the 50 other states. So there's a very good chance it would also be overturned in Washington State if it got to a court challenge. Mm-hmm. But what we're seeing here is an effort by Republican Secretary of State Sam Reid, and of course it's not just a Republican issue, because a lot of Democrats are terrified of being associated with the dread words income tax also, to really stop that conversation before it starts, even though some sort of tax restructuring desperately needs to happen in this state, because as Gregoire has been saying this week, I want to raise revenue, and I don't want to raise sales tax, and I don't want to raise property tax, and I don't want to raise B&O tax. Well, those are the only three taxes that are available to the state. So what other options are there aside from, gambling and sin taxes of that type, which is really a very limited remedy for...
And closing B&O and excise tax loopholes, which
is off the table.
Yeah, there's been no political will to do that in the legislature this year.
Or any other year, for that matter.
Yeah, oxymoron, political will. All right, let's move on to national news and this week's economic news.
Yeah, I'm going to talk a little bit about the budget. President Obama gave the Congress his draft budget on Monday, and the total budget amount this year is $3.8 trillion, and $1.6 trillion of that will be deficit spending. Now, what was very interesting to me about this budget was the military entitlement program. I'm calling it the entitlement program because that's how it's usually presented. The total military budget is set as $708 billion.
That's the total Department of Defense budget.
That's what I meant. And then the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq will get an additional $33 billion this year, so that the total will be $160 billion for our war spending. Now, does anybody remember when John Kerry was running for president and when he said that the war in Iraq would cost around $200 billion, and then everybody immediately came out and laughed at him and ridiculed him for saying that? And here we are, 2010, the wars have been going on for almost a decade now, and we're spending $160 billion a year to fund those wars.
And that's not even counting things like VA health care. It's not counting the nuclear mm-hmm. complex. It's not counting the interest on the debt that's attributable
it's
to past wars.
It's not counting funding to the State Department, and they're heavily involved in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Not counting the intelligence services, which is, is much
Homeland
of how it's
security,
being how the war is being prosecuted. The overall discretionary military spending is well over half of the new federal budget, and yet, as we saw with the spending freeze that Obama announced a couple of weeks ago, military spending was exempt. It's like an income tax in Washington State. It can't even be brought up for discussion, and it needs to be.
Yeah. And it's, they're looking at the deficit and they go, well, geez, deficit is about 11% of our annual gross domestic product. And to be sustainable, the deficit should really be no more than 3%. Well, if you look back in our history, it's no coincidence that the other times in our history when it's been at 11% or above has been during World War I, during World War II, even during the Civil War. It's no coincidence that that's when we've had massive budget deficits. So you can listen to people blaming the deficit on the economy or on the bank bailouts or whatever, but they'd be absolutely wrong. The deficit has two causes. It's our massive, massive waste of money on military spending, and it's because of the Bush-era tax cuts. So I thought it was kind of interesting this week when the White House Chief Economic Advisor Larry Summers said, quote, "How long can the world's biggest borrower remain the world's biggest power?" Because you look at a statement like that and you go, okay, that is kind of interesting, because right now China, we know in the past that China has been largely funding our deficit by buying massive amounts of U.S. Treasury bonds. Well, China in the last year or so has been cutting back on buying U.S. government debt. Now, other nations are stepping in a little bit to buy up some of that debt, but the difference is mostly being made up by U.S. investors. Well, U.S. investors, though, are a pretty fickle bunch. If they see a better deal somewhere else, that's where they take their money, and that's where their money goes.
Yeah, they tend not to be long-term investors.
Yeah, they're not necessarily long-term investors. So I think we're in a pretty precarious situation here as far as the U.S. government debt and interest rates.
All right, and jobs report out this week?
Yeah, the Labor Department issued their jobs report this week. They said that new claims for unemployment benefits increased by 8,000 in the past week, up to 480,000. Economists expected it to actually drop. They expected the number to drop to 460,000. So even though we thought you've been hearing news in the past month or so that, oh, gosh, you know, unemployment is getting better, you know, people are going back to work, et cetera, that's not necessarily the case. And you may see, I think there was an announcement this morning of U.S. official U.S. unemployment dropping to 9.7%. Well, if you really look at the figures, what we're seeing is not a lot of rehiring. We're seeing a slight slackening in the number of people who were kicked out of their jobs in January, but we're also seeing a much larger number of people just completely fall off the rolls. So there are people who are losing their benefits, but they're not going back to work. So they're going from becoming officially unemployed to the unofficial unemployed.
And how about the FHA?
Oh, yeah. The FHA reported that 9.1% of the borrowers whose mortgage loans were insured by the FHA, the Federal Housing Administration, have missed at least three mortgage payments as of December. That's a very high default rate, and it's about double what you find elsewhere at other banks and even at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Now, FHA doesn't make mortgage loans directly. What they do is they insure loans that are made by partners, that is, other lenders who are partners with the FHA. And what's interesting is that the FHA covers those defaults, those loan losses, with money from their cash reserves. Those cash reserves come from fees that are paid by people who take out FHA-insured loans. Well, when those cash reserves run out, and they are dangerously low right now, then guess who gets to foot the bill for rising defaults at the FHA? Taxpayers, of course. So even though Obama is talking about trying to close the deficit and wanting to close the deficit, it looks like the FHA, which is running out of its cash reserves at a time when its loan default rate is just getting higher and higher and higher, may open up yet another big crater in the federal budget.
That moves us on then to developments with ClimateGate.
Yeah, Michael Mann, who is notorious among climate change deniers for the hockey stick graph of increasing greenhouse gas emissions, and one of the scientists implemented in the hacking of East Anglia University emails last December, was investigated. He's on the staff at, or on the faculty rather, at Penn State University. He was investigated by a Penn State panel for wrongdoing and in the allegations that he had covered up contradictory data on climate change research. And they came out with their findings this week, and the findings were, and this is a direct quote, that there exists no credible evidence that Dr. Mann had or has ever engaged in or participated in, directly or indirectly, any actions with an intent to suppress or to falsify data. While a perception has been created, I love the passive tense there, while a perception has been created in the weeks after the CRU emails were made public, that Dr. Mann has engaged in the suppression or falsification of data, there is no credible evidence that he ever did so. In other words, there was no ClimateGate scandal. The whole thing was an overblown media event. But this raises another interesting question, that we still don't know how those emails were hacked, or who hacked them, or why it just so happened that the timing of it was such that the emails were hacked, and then within 24 hours, out of the thousands of emails that were hacked, a few were cherry-picked and released to the media just in a few days before the Copenhagen UN summit on climate change. A lot of speculation has appeared in the British press that would have had to have been the work of an intelligence agency, just because of the nature of the protection and the firewalls that were in place to keep anybody anybody from accessing those emails and those backup servers. So, but that has sort of speculation has not appeared in the press, in the U.S. media. So, a lot of unanswered questions as to what the money is behind that so-called scandal. And, of course, a lot of people will come away with the perception that that was a scandal, but in fact it wasn't.
All right. And political appointee given out get-out-of-jail-free cards.
Yeah, a Barack Obama political appointee, David Margolis, in the Department of Justice downgraded the Office of Personal Responsibilities finding that Jay Bybee and John Yoo in the Bush administration in 2002-2003 had violated their professional obligations as lawyers when they crafted their memos approving torture in the Bush administration. That finding was downgraded to having shown poor judgment, and what that means by downgrading it is that rather than risking being disbarred, and in the case of Bybee, who was rewarded by Bush with a lifetime federal judgeship appointee, they then instead just get a slap on the wrist and face no risk of either disbarment or impeachment. So once again, zero accountability for torture or war crimes under the Bush administration.
Yeah, you wouldn't want John Yoo to lose his professorship at Berkeley now, would you?
No. And the opportunity to mold impressionable young minds?
No.
All right. That leaves us just a couple minutes for international and Haiti.
Yeah, ugly scandal unfolding involving an Idaho Baptist church and a leader who was busted for kidnapping and child trafficking in Haiti this week, along with nine other church members and missionaries. Those other nine people are trying to extract themselves from what it appears to have been a scheme involving the woman who is the ringleader, a woman named Laura Silsby, who, among other things, has had 14 suits for unpaid wages, another 8 civil lawsuits against her, a foreclosed house, 4 different citations for failure to register or insure a car, no registration for the Dominican Republic, quote-unquote, orphanage that she was allegedly transferring some 33 Haitian children ages 2 to 12 to. This is reminiscent of some scandals that have appeared in war and disaster zones before, in which Western church-related groups or missionaries wind up being implicated in what essentially boiled down to child trafficking rings or adoption scams, where in the case of the Haitian group, they were saying that the Dominican orphanage was to set the children up to be adopted out, even though a lot of these children actually had parents. It's a very ugly scandal that, as in the case of Chad a couple of years ago with a French group and a Virginia-based missionary group in South Asia after the tsunami in 2005, once again, disaster capitalism meets religion, and the results
are not good.
Not good at all.
Oh. All right. And very briefly, Israel and Gaza.
Yeah, a high-ranking officer of the Israeli Defense Forces said this week that he had served in the Israeli command center during the invasion of Gaza recently, and that the Israeli military command made the direct decision to change the rules of engagement. Instead of trying to preserve civilian life and follow international law, they made the decision to shoot on sight. So essentially to shoot anything that moves within the Gaza Strip areas where the Israeli Defense Forces were operating. And this is the first time that someone within the Israeli Defense Forces, within the Israeli military, came out and verified what Palestinians have been saying about the invasion of Gaza.
Right.
So big news, big in the UK, but you didn't see anything about it here in the US.
Events.
Yeah, this coming Friday, February 12th, Joe Biden is going to be in town. He's doing a fundraiser for Patty Murray, two of your favorite people. And I'm sure the Tea Party folks will be out protesting socialism and communism and all those horrible things. But there will also be people protesting war funding and torture and some of the more odious practices of the Obama administration that Murray has also been complicit in. That'll be from 8:30 to 10 a.m. on Friday morning this coming week at the Westin Hotel, 1900 Fifth Avenue in downtown Seattle.
You mean Patty? Did you say Maria or Patty?
Patty Murray.
Oh.
Patty Murray.
Murray. There you go. Talking as we do every week with John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State comes out every couple of weeks with the news and commentary and humor and all those good things. You can find it, when we're publishing the print edition, you can find it where you find free publications. We're not actually publishing the print edition this time because we're trying to save some money. We're in the middle of our winter fund drive, and we're trying to decide, frankly, whether to keep publishing the print edition or whether to go to web only. We've gotten quite a bit of support in the last couple of weeks, and we really appreciate that, but we're still not quite to the goal that we want. We want to raise another $1,500 or so. I don't have the exact number in front of me in the next couple of weeks, and we need your help to do that. So if you can go to www.eatthestate.org, the latest news and content is there, but also there's a PayPal button where you can make a donation, or you can send a check or money order to P.O. Box 855-419-8145, Seattle, Washington. And if you missed any of that information, or you'd like more information on how to help out, or if you'd like to offer feedback and figure out ways that we can save our print edition, give us an email. Our email is info@eatthestate.org.